Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Depolarizers podcast. Today I'm excited to be in conversation with Josh Barrow, who you may remember from Welcome Fest in July. Josh is a journalist focused on politics and the economy from a centrist Democratic perspective. He writes the Substack newsletter Very Serious, which you can find at joshbarrow.com. Recently, his election postmortem was titled, Trump Didn't Deserve to Win, But We Deserved to Lose. Before going to Substack, Josh did stints as a correspondent at the New York Times. He was a business columnist for New York Magazine, and he was a commentary writer for Business Insider. He also co-hosts the legal podcast, Serious Trouble. Thanks for listening. All right, Josh, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Lauren.
I so enjoyed meeting you at Welcome Fest this year. You moderated a great panel. Granted, I was on it, so I have to have some hubris in that. It was a great panel, Not just me. Rachel Genfaza and Olivia Giuliana, we had a great conversation. I sent you a note earlier this month, and I was just like, I really enjoyed your writing post-election, as obviously I always enjoy your writing, but like, I wanted you to be one of the voices that we heard from post-election because I really respect you. Before we get into some of the nitty gritty stuff today, for folks who don't know much about you, do you mind telling us a little bit about yourself and even like the concepts and things that really are of most interest to you these days?
Sure. So I'm a journalist. I write mostly on politics and the economy, but obviously those are both very broad topics. I used to be at places like the New York Times, New York Magazine, Business Insider, but I've been an independent journalist for the last 3 years. I write a newsletter on Substack called Very Serious. I also on the side happen to host a legal podcast called Serious Trouble, although that's a sort of somewhat separate project. In the lead up to the election, I was very focused on, trying to build a strong center-left Democratic Party that can draw a majority in national elections, which we didn't get to this time. I am a Democrat. I used to be a Republican back in the day. I wrote a lot that was critical of the Republican Party back when I was Republican. Now I write a lot, helpful criticism of the Democratic Party, tough love, trying to, get the party to stop doing stupid shit, stop doing unpopular shit, and stop creating the sort of situations that we had in this election where, obviously, inflation was the number one political problem that the Democrats faced, like incumbent parties all over the world. But another one of Democrats' biggest problems was that Kamala Harris was perceived as too liberal by a lot more voters than perceived Donald Trump as too conservative. For all his extremism and his rhetoric, Donald Trump has really, in certain ways, moved the Republican Party toward the center on issues like Social Security, Medicare, gay marriage, compared to where the party was under Mitt Romney. And there have been electoral dividends for that. You saw him in this election trying really hard to run away from unpopular positions on abortion that are an electoral liability for Republicans, but not as large a liability as they would be if Trump had not been explicitly trying to cultivate a moderate image on that issue. And I think Democrats just, in this campaign did not effectively succeed at, similarly adapting their positions to the median voter.
So as we go into next year, I'll be following especially the economic policy fights that happen in Washington. There will be a major tax law passed. And even though Republicans are in the majority, they have such a narrow majority in the House of Representatives. I think there is likely to be an important role for Democrats to play in opposing bad ideas, but also in finding certain places to work together when Republicans will decide they actually need Democrats to get things done that they want to do. But I'll also be focusing on, how the party can better position itself next time and not get caught out on cost of living and crime and immigration in particular as issues where, voters just perceive the Democrats as being out of touch and not focused on their everyday concerns, causing them to choose Republicans.
I love that. I feel like I should ask this question, but like, do you see anyone in the party right now who could be entrusted with some of these changes? Are there leaders who are standing out to you? Are there, even if they're like, governors or state representatives or whatever, but is there anyone that you're like, okay, I think that the positioning shifts that must occur could be entrusted to some of these people?
Yeah, as I look at the bench of governors, I think that, I think we have a number of appealing swing state governors. Who have run ahead of Kamala Harris and Joe Biden in their states, who have shown, an attention to where the median voter actually is. I mean, I, I'm particularly a fan of Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, who, you know, his approval rating is somewhere around 60%, won a very big majority in his first election. Now, granted, he ran against a very flawed Republican candidate, as tends to happen from time to time. But I think, you know, in addition to showing a real focus on kitchen table issues and trying to find creative ways to get around the usual ideological divides, I mean, one of his initiatives, for example, is making many more government jobs in Pennsylvania available to people regardless of whether or not they have a college degree. I think he's pointed out correctly that we have a certain amount of credentialism in this society. And, you know, we haven't thought deeply about, is this degree requirement actually necessary for this specific role? So I think it's a smart way to do government hiring, but it's not a left-right issue. It's something you can put out there, and it's not, oh, I'm in favor of that because I'm conservative or I'm liberal. It's a way to sort of get around the usual divides and appeal to people on both sides. But also, maybe more importantly, he's shown a willingness to stand up to people in the party coalition when they want to do things that are unpopular. I mean, you know, circa 2022, when he was still attorney general, 2023, you had these efforts to reimpose pandemic era COVID restrictions in certain circumstances, for example, in the city of Philadelphia. And a lot of Democrats knew that was unpopular at that point, knew that the country was ready to move on, but didn't want to get yelled at on social media. There, you know, were some people in our coalition who were very passionate about the idea that we should basically wear masks and hide in our homes forever. And he was able to come out and say, you know, what the city of Philadelphia is doing is wrong and I oppose it. And that's, you know, those are the sorts of decisions where it's not just, you know, there's lots of ideas that you can pull that test well, that won't make anyone angry, but often they're, you know, they're not the key issue that voters are focused on at that moment. He showed a willingness to say that this thing the party's doing is unpopular and I'm going to stand up against it, even though some people on my side are going to get mad at me. And so that's really what I'm looking for in someone who can be a presidential candidate, because I think that that was really missing on a number of these issues, especially around crime and immigration. In the 2024 cycle, the Democrats needed to part with what was conventional wisdom on the Democratic side in a way that Bill Clinton very often did when he was president, and people get mad at you on your own side. Jared Polis, the governor of Colorado, is another person who's shown willingness to do this. I mean, frankly, he's done it in some ways that I disagree with. I think he's basically said that he's excited to see RFK Jr. running the Department of Health and Human Services. And I get both that there are things that the health establishment gets wrong, and there are aspects of personal choice, which I know is where Governor Polis is very focused, that, you know, the regardless of the medical merits of vaccines, that you need to, you know, give people choice about what goes in their own bodies. I both get that as an ideological view, and I get it as a coalition management thing. He says, you know, here in Colorado, a lot of these crunchy people, they vote Democrat. They don't want the government telling them what to put in their body. I get that as a political matter. There's a whole bunch of other things that RFK Jr. believes and has advocated that are, you know, often very stupid, or, you know, likely to be quite damaging to public health. So that's not the choice I would have picked. But I still get the impulse there where he's saying, you know, I mean, this is Iglesias's line, Matt Iglesias, that, you know, there's a lot of cranks out there. And it used to be that about half of them voted for us. And if, you know, if we partisanize being a crank and worrying about fluoride and water and that sort of thing, you know, we can feel good about ourselves for not falling in for stupid pseudoscience fads. But if we lose all of those votes, we have to go find those votes somewhere else. And to the extent that we can bracket these issues and, you know, be like, you know, yes, you can have crazy ideas about 5G or beef tallow or whatever and still vote for Democrats, you want to find ways to do that. So I appreciate his impulse there, even if I haven't agreed with every single way that he's gone about following it.
Totally. And I think that you hit on two points that I've been kind of chewing on the past few weeks too, is like, one, leaders who have the courage to be different or have different perspectives from the rest of the group, right? We were at the New Deal Leaders Conference a few weeks ago and just kind of talking about, like, you know, leaders need to be courageous in the Democratic Party. They need to be able to stand up to people and say, like, I don't agree with you on this, and I'm allowed to have a nuanced perspective. And even to your point about RFK Jr., you know, while might not be the best in terms of public health safety, but, you know, he has a shift from the norm of what people are used to when it comes to politicians, which is one of the reasons, obviously, why Trump is popular himself. So I do think that there's something there, to your point. I think that that is going to be something that is going to be important for the next few cycles. Kind of going off of that, let's talk about policy mistakes. I'm increasingly convinced that the left just doesn't recognize when they're wrong about policy and admit that they've made mistakes. And I have something that you've written, which is Democrats have to be willing to get on the popular side of the 70-30 policy issues, even if they're going to upset some activists on their side. So are there some things that we can and should do to better gauge our accuracy on policy stances, or how do we get better policy production of who's writing it, who's confirming it, who's agreeing with it kind of thing? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when I said that, it was in specific reference to Proposition 36, which was a ballot measure in the state of California that increased certain penalties for drug and shoplifting crimes. And, you know, if you've gone into a CVS, you've seen all the goods locked up. And there's a number of social factors that have driven this, including that it's easier to resell these things on Facebook Marketplace and eBay than it was 10 years ago. But part of the problem is that people have basically figured out that if you go into a store and take all the stuff off the shelves and walk out, nobody's going to stop you. You're very unlikely to get in trouble with the law. And people are frustrated with this on a number of measures. Some of it is actual like convenience and cost. I don't like having stuff behind the behind the locks. I know that ultimately we as consumers pay for the cost of shoplifting. But there's also a fundamental sense of fairness here that basically, you know, people are being allowed to go out there and break the law. And other people who work hard for a living and pay for the products they buy, they see that as very unfair. And they see Democrats as being more focused on the needs of people who might get caught up in the criminal justice system than on the needs of people who are just going about their days following the law and wanting to go find products that they can pay for with their own money. And so Prop 36 was part of the pushback on this in California. And the idea is essentially that it's been very difficult to get the police to do these prosecutions because they know that there's very unlikely to be a significant penalty, even if you bring someone to the police station and arrest them for shoplifting. And so partly it's about the penalties themselves, but partly it's about creating an environment where you can actually go out and enforce those. And in addition to passing the proposition, you saw that voters in California, they recalled the district attorney in Alameda County, where Oakland is. They voted out the progressive DA in Los Angeles County in favor of a former Republican. So there's clear public energy, even in a blue state like California, behind the idea that we need more enforcement of these sorts of low-level crimes around disorder. It's not just about violent crime. I mean, violent crime, it did go up in 2020. It has been coming down. Democrats, you know, really like to point out that violent crime is decreasing and public opinion on that has lagged a little bit. But there's still all these problems with disorder and petty theft, and people are upset about it, and they want something done about it. And so Prop 36 passed with 69% of the vote. And the polling ahead of the election said that Prop 36 was going to pass overwhelmingly. It actually won every county. It even won San Francisco. There was a vote for law and order all over the state of California. And Kamala Harris, who is a resident of the state of California, was asked about the proposition a few days before the election. And she just basically said, I don't want to get into that. And what we as a party need is we need to be able to look at something where the public is screaming out and saying, We find this unacceptable. We need a policy solution to this. And that policy solution needs to involve more law enforcement. We need to be able to agree with that. We need to be able to go out there and say, yeah, I'm mad about the stuff behind, you know, being locked up at Walgreens too. And I want to make shoplifting illegal again. And I'm going to vote for Proposition 36. It's kind of a funny thing because Donald Trump got all this pressure during the campaign to take a position on the abortion question that was going to be on the ballot in Florida where he votes. And he had sort of flip-flopped on that. It was a known thing that if you're a candidate, you might get asked about the ballot measures you're going to vote on, even if voters all over the country are not voting on them. One of the many disappointing things to me about the Harris campaign and their, you know, failure to adapt is that they weren't ready for that. And they weren't ready to say, this is a place where we can break with certain progressive activists and we can be on the side of 70% of the public. They turned down that opportunity. She had other problems, which is that she had taken a whole bunch of out there positions in 2019, 2020. And so even if she repudiated them, that doesn't delete the fact that you took them previously, that you're on camera saying them, that the Trump campaign can spend tens of millions of dollars running ads with your former video. But at least if you're out there saying, I was wrong, I feel differently now, and maybe with an explanation of why beyond just my values haven't changed, which is the mantra she said over and over, then you can regain some trust of the voters and show them that you've moved where they are. Instead, voters, you know, one of the things they kept telling pollsters was that they see Democrats as focused on these, you know, social issues over and above things that were mattering to them, like inflation and immigration, and, you know, trans issues was at the top of that. It's not that Kamala Harris was talking a lot about trans issues in this campaign. She wasn't. But she filled out this questionnaire in 2019 And she talked on camera about the importance of providing trans surgeries to incarcerated prisoners and to people in immigration detention. And she had nothing new to say about that this time that, you know, might have, you know, at least said, you know, well, that I was wrong on my priorities, or I've seen, 4 years being vice president. You know, this is really not something that should be the focus of the Bureau of Prisons. You could say something different, because otherwise all people have to look at is this video of you from some years ago taking an unpopular position on an issue that people cannot believe would be a priority for you.
Yeah, which I so love that you mentioned this. Our friends at More in Common actually put out a report, I think right after the election, because they polled people right after the election. And it essentially says literally what you're just saying is like people perceive Democrats' priorities to be something like, I'll just read the report. It says like they perceive their priorities to be abortion, LGBT trans policy and climate change, when Democrats' actual priorities are inflation, healthcare, and abortion. And then they perceive Republicans' priorities to be immigration, economy, and inflation. And their actual priorities are the immigration, economy, and the inflation. So it's like, it's so crazy that, to your point, people perceive our priorities to be completely different than what they, even with like the ads that Democrats ran. Like I know, I think Ben or Matt at Slowborn were talking about the ads that Democrats ran this election cycle, which were very keen to voters' actual priorities. But again, the perception gap and the priority gap, as More Common wrote about, is huge here, which is scary.
Yeah.
So maybe like, would you have any prescriptions? Like if you could, you know, bottle up some drugs for the Democrat, like actual drugs, but like, you know, prescription bottle of solutions for the Democratic Party, for the left particularly, like, you know, what do we do here?
Well, I mean, I think on some of these issues, it's specific things to the issues. I think you need to say on things like crime that, you know, we need to prosecute more low-level offenses. We need to do the sorts of things that Prop 36 was looking for. And that, you know, it's appropriate for people to be concerned that, you know, they walk out of their house and they see, you know, they see prostitution or they see shoplifting. I mean, here, I live in New York City. There was a huge swing toward Republicans in the outer boroughs, especially Hispanic and Asian neighborhoods in the outer boroughs. And a very good piece for New York Magazine by Simon Van Zylen Wood, who went out to Corona, which is a very Hispanic neighborhood in Queens. And there's a specific problem with prostitution on Roosevelt Avenue, the main drag through there, and a lot of trafficking that is being done by Venezuelan migrants. And you have a lot of people who themselves are immigrants to the United States, often from Latin America, who are complaining about, you know, what's going on with all these new Venezuelan migrants around them. It's not racist to be concerned about that, and it is not unusual to be concerned about that. And so I think, you know, I think the Democratic Party tried to make a turn toward that. Toward the end of the Biden administration, I think, you know, pushing toward the Lankford bill on border security was a good choice. They should have done it 3 years earlier. But basically, you know, for too long, they listened to the so-called groups that basically just, you know, saw lax immigration enforcement as a good in itself. I think Democrats eventually learned that the groups there have no political juice. There's no real political constituency in the United States for, you know, uncontrolled migration into the country. So I think actually on that issue, Democrats, they sort of figured out most of where they needed to get on it. They just did it too late. But I think when candidates are coming up in 2028, the challenge is going to be now Donald Trump is going to be overseeing immigration enforcement. And the reflex for Democrats is just to say no, no, no. And to say, you know, how mean, how awful you're being. The underlying politics of immigration has shifted a lot since last time Donald Trump was president. The migrant crisis, you know, brought millions of additional people into the United States. And people are pissed off about it. And so Democrats are actually going to have to find ways to cooperate with him, or at least show that, you know, even if they have disagreements on certain policy specifics, that they share the objective of reducing irregular migration into the U.S. And, you know, actually getting, you know, some people who are never going to have a valid asylum claim here to leave the country. So I think that, you know, that's a challenge for the party. I think on crime, it's just, you know, it's a matter of, I mean, Gavin Newsom has even done some of this himself in California. He's one of my least favorite politicians, but it is true that he understands the way the disorder issue has mattered in California in a way that some other Democrats haven't, and understands that more enforcement is needed there. And then on cost of living, obviously, next time we won't be running as incumbents responsible for high inflation. So that will be good. And Donald Trump has some of his own inflationary ideas, so he might have a negative record on inflation that we can run against. But I think it's, you know, the part of the problem there is that because of the climate agenda, we are perceived as the party that wants to make gasoline more expensive. And I think that just puts us at a disadvantage compared to Republicans when we talk about making things affordable on store shelves. There's this idea coming from certain areas of the left that what we need here is more populism and more talk about how, you know, we're fighting against billionaires. And I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with that kind of talk. It's certainly true that the Republican tax agenda to give tax breaks to billionaires is unpopular, and we should run against that. But I think when people, you know, look at why things are expensive in the store, they don't see that as being about billionaires. Just as like it's not about billionaires that there's prostitution on your street. It's not about billionaires that things are locked up behind, you know, in locked cages. And so I think, you know, focusing on, you know, what people actually see as the drivers, the high cost of living in their lives, one of which is energy. And so I think, you know, the funny thing is Joe Biden presided over record domestic oil and gas production. But he was afraid to talk about that because the perception seemed to be that if you talk about it, you just make the climate left mad. And then, I don't know, I guess they're going to stay home or something. You know, the voters whose primary focus is climate change are some of the most institutional focused voters out there. I think it's very different from like Gaza. Gaza was not a top issue, but it's true that there are people who are super focused on Gaza and they're willing to stay home or vote for the Green Party because they're mad about it. The sorts of people who wake up in the morning and, you know, the biggest thing they're concerned about is greenhouse gas emissions, those are generally really partisan people who will vote Democratic, even if they don't feel that you're going far enough on their issue. So I think, you know, to go back to the Obama messaging of an all-of-the-above energy strategy where we are focused on keeping prices low and having abundant energy, and part of how you have abundant energy is that you invest in clean energy. It's not just about, you know, drill for as much oil as possible only. But I think that, you know, getting back to that message, I think will help to convince voters that we can be trusted on these cost of living issues, because just saying billionaires, billionaires, billionaires is not going to do it.
Yeah. And I think that the trust piece is going to be critical moving forward. So I appreciate you really honing in on that, because even my analogy about the prescription drugs, it's like, that's kind of like a Band-Aid solution sometimes. Like, you have to like kind of go in and like really address the root of some of these problems, which is you know, authenticity and all the trustworthiness on just being wrong on policy and being able to be accountable, right? Your point even about the Harris campaign not even saying like, you know what, we were wrong about this and we are now here. Like, that would have earned so much trust among people, because they're like, yeah, you know, I make mistakes in my day-to-day life. I'm glad to see that this person who wants to be president of the United States can admit that they were wrong about it too. You know, I think that's critical. So you touched on something that I also am very interested to hear your thoughts on. Where do you think that we have opportunities to agree with the Trump administration on policy? Obviously love the spicy takes on our podcast here. And, you know, even just like your thoughts on where we might not be completely misaligned with their policy takes.
Yeah, I mean, I think two of the main areas have to do with immigration and energy. And these are areas that were areas for possible bipartisan cooperation during the Biden administration, where legislation didn't ultimately get to the president's desk and get signed, but there was energy on both sides on Capitol Hill willing to cut bipartisan deals to address problems that still exist, even though Donald Trump is now president and that he now has an incentive to fix. On the immigration side, you know, there's some talk that Republicans are going to try to use the budget reconciliation process to address border issues. The budget reconciliation is this process where you can get through the Senate with only 50 votes. You don't need 60 to get over a filibuster. It can only be used for budgetary matters. So they could do certain spending related to the border that they want to do there. But I don't think they're going to be able to do some of the things they really need to do that the Biden administration was saying it needed to do, which had to do with changing the law around how asylum is claimed and, you know, what rights someone has when they show up at the border of the United States and, you know, probably don't have a really good asylum claim, but we have a years-long backlog before we can get them in front of a judge to adjudicate it. A lot of those people are just being released into the country, and they are not here illegally once they're in here, but they don't have a good long-term right to be here. And if and when that asylum claim is ultimately adjudicated, then in theory we can remove them. But at that point, they may have lived in the U.S. for 7 years, and then the argument will be, well, gee, this person's lived here for 7 years. Do you really want to send them back to Venezuela? It's a system that does not work. And so some of the reforms that were in the bipartisan bill that Republican Senator James Lankford was one of the architects of, the Trump administration is still going to need some of those. Now, they're going to say, well, we're just going to go do these things. And they'll have aggressive interpretations of the law. But what we saw in the first Trump administration, and to some extent in the Biden administration, was you run into the courts and they say, no, you can't do that. So they really will be better off if we can change the law. And I think both Republicans and Democrats see that the immigration situation is unsustainable. So I think there are opportunities for some bipartisan agreement on reforms that the Trump administration will find useful for enforcement. And then Democrats will have a seat at the table and they'll have an ability to get some, you know, agenda items of their own in there, as were in that Lankford bill. that did not make it all the way through. Similarly, on energy, one of the things that the Trump administration is insistent about is that the budget deficit won't be as high as people think because they're going to preside over really high economic growth. And they have unreasonable expectations of how high that growth can be. But there are things the government can do that will affect what the growth rate is. And one of those is if we have more energy production, we will have more economic growth. And so there are environmental law barriers to permitting for all kinds of energy projects. This is both oil and gas projects and then also electrical transmission lines and the installation of clean energy projects. And there have been these ongoing efforts in Congress to get some sort of bipartisan deal that eases the path for permitting for both fossil fuel projects and green energy projects. I think, you know, if you're a liberal focused on this, I think the important thing to remember is that a lot of the fossil fuel infrastructure is already there. It doesn't need to be permitted because it already exists. To build out a green energy future, we have to build a lot of new stuff, and that has to go through permitting. So really, it's the liberal side of this question that has the larger stake in permitting reform, because we need more things built than they do. But there are things to build on both sides. And so I think that there are real opportunities for a partisan agreement there that will make energy cheaper and make the economy grow, and that will, you know, in the long run, foster a transition away from fossil fuels. So I think that's another place where there should be possibilities for bipartisan cooperation. Now, the unfortunate thing is, last time around, the Trump administration was really bad at working with Democrats. The incoming president is not that good at making nice across the aisle. One of Joe Biden's actual political strengths was that he was quite good at these congressional negotiations. So I'm concerned that Trump will basically fall on his face politically and not create the conditions where it's possible to have these bipartisan agreements. But certainly we should be coming to the table and putting in a good faith effort and trying.
100%. Shifting gears just a little bit. You talked a little bit before about like the center left and, you know, how we can be more factional and cultivate the things that we need to be a robust and thriving faction for that matter. How do you think a coalition in the center advances that type of faction and even factional leaders to win election cycles in the year to come? Like, what are your thoughts on essentially just building the center?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a political organizer, so I don't, in terms of, you know, exactly what those structures should look like, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, there have been past examples, most notably the Democratic Leadership Council in the 1980s and the 1990s. Part of the problem is that, you know, the progressive factions, it's a coalition of groups of people who are passionate about one issue. You know, you have the environmental groups, and you have the LGBTQ groups, and you have the pro-immigration groups and childcare. There's all these individual, you know, passions that you have. And then they've sort of gotten together and agreed that they're going to have an omni-cause and they're going to support each other's issues. And this has led the party into some unfortunate choices as a political matter. But as a, you know, a coalition structural matter, it works. It creates the way to organize. And it also amplifies your voice beyond, you know, what is actually representative of the voters. I mean, I think part of why the 2019 primary got so crazy is that people really thought that, you know, the ACLU and NARAL, and, you know, by the way, I don't want to single out the abortion groups, because I think abortion is actually a strong political issue for Democrats. And I don't think it's been a problem that we've, only very rarely has it been a problem that we actually get too far out on abortion. I think that's an issue we should press. But we have all of these, you know, these groups that created the impression that where the typical Democratic voter is all the way out where the progressive activists are. And in fact, you know, most people in the coalition, they're not all the way to the left on everything. And you saw that when you actually started having voting in the 2020 primaries, and you had, you know, the Joe Biden ends up winning the primaries, and you have a majority of voters who reject the idea that you want a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren vision for what the future of the party should be. So those moderate voters are out there. The question is what they have in common with each other that makes it possible to create, you know, an actual organization that brings them together. That's sort of what you're doing for a living. I'd be interested in what you think that looks like.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. We've got all sorts of plans. I was just curious because, you know, coming from different elements of the ecosystem, I'm always curious to see what people's thoughts are. Our major premise right now is like, you know, organize, not debate. You know, it's very fun to be online chattering among one another, but one that doesn't necessarily get you very far. And two can be perceived as just kind of elitist and obnoxious by some people. It's like, oh, you just sit online and talk and you don't do stuff, you know? So, you know, we got to,
it's also kind of,
Go ahead.
It can be a waste of time. I mean, you know, if you're sitting on Twitter yelling at someone who has a hammer and sickle in their display name, you are probably not doing useful and important political activity that is resulting in the winning of elections. And you see this especially in the debate around housing, that you have the YIMBY movement, which has had a lot of successes. And so I think it is, you know, it has been an effective political movement. But a lot of organized YIMBYs spend a lot of time fighting with people on the far left and trying to convince them, you know, why, you know, housing shouldn't just be built by the government. And they're not spending enough time arguing with people whose literal complaint is, I want to know where I can park my car. I don't like this tall building next to my house. Those people are not as loud online, but they are a lot more politically powerful in, you know, in public meetings and in city council elections. That's your enemy if you're organizing there. And I think if you get, you know, too Twitter brained, you sort of forget that those are the people who are really standing against you. And so I think it's another example of where being too online takes away your situational awareness, and you don't realize exactly what you need to argue to whom in order to win.
Oh, 1,000%. I had a really good conversation with a woman named Jillian who works at YIMBY at the Abundance Conference last month, I think, or 2 months ago. And I was like talking to her about how they engage with people. And she was saying, yeah, like we get people to, you know, within their own neighborhoods and talk to the zoning people and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, that is literally the democracy that we're always talking about, right? When you are actually going to your legislators, or your city council people or whatever, and engaging with residents and voters, that is them seeing their democracy at play. Like you said, it's not just online. It's like literally if you take it to the actual people who are being affected, they get to see the democracy at work and they're like, okay, we might want to fight for this thing, right? So I totally appreciate and agree with that.
Yeah.
So before Election Day, I'm shifting gears again here and I'm trying to be mindful of time.
Sure.
But you before Election Day were writing about newspaper endorsements. And I really liked this one because I was like, yes, somebody finally said it. You wrote, this choice wrecked mainstream newsroom's ability to be taken seriously by conservative readers and therefore contributed heavily to the fragmentation of the public's grip on reality nationally and in their own neighborhoods, a problem that journalists can constantly bemoan without pausing to consider their own role in causing it. So like, I just really appreciated this. Do you think we'll see any type of reform in how these types of endorsements work in cycles to come, whether it's publications, celebrities, et cetera, just because I've been curious to see the role of endorsements in the future.
So the choice that I'm referring to there that wrecked that trust is not simply the publication of endorsements, which obviously is something that newspapers had done for, you know, more than a century. It's the way that so much of the press conceived itself as in opposition to Donald Trump. And they were tempted to do that in part because Donald Trump conceives himself in opposition to the press. The fight was brought to them and they chose to take it. And for a time, it sold subscriptions at places like the Washington Post. There was also a business reason to do it. But a lot of journalists became very openly advocates over the last 10 years or so. And even though those people very often really do have deep subject matter expertise and know a lot about the subjects they're reporting on, that makes it very difficult for people to trust them when they realize that the values they hold are different from the values that dominate within those newsrooms, which are almost entirely staffed by not just Democrats, but, you know, as you get into the younger generations, by people who are very left wing. And I think that's been a huge problem for press credibility. And it's very difficult to fix because this is your personnel. And it comes from the bottom. Well, sometimes it comes from the top down, like when the Washington Post prints "Democracy Dies in Darkness" on the masthead. So sometimes it's been encouraged by management, and management needs to take a different tack. But this is the way that a lot of people who are journalists for a living, it's what they want to do, and it's what they believe is the right way to do journalism. This is, you know, a very live debate within the industry. So I think it's really hard. And I also think, you know, if the Washington Post in particular, spent a decade positioning itself as this sort of resistance newspaper, even if you do totally change what's in the news report, it takes a long time for people to notice that and to credit it again. And then even if you do, it's not clear to me that it works as a business model is the other thing. And that, you know, the press, the decline of classified ads and of, you know, of lucrative print circulation, it's, you know, this huge decades-long economic decline in the industry. And very often you have newspapers with one business model that's not working, and then you have a proposal for a different business model that, you know, might be ideologically different or less ideological, but that business model also won't work economically. So I think it's a very hard problem. I don't know that I have a good solution to it. And, you know, in particular, when I look at the Washington Post and they say, well, you know, we could, you know, we've hired these editors from, you know, the sort of more centrist to center right, you know, British type outlets. And maybe we can reposition ourselves sort of more where the Wall Street Journal is. The Wall Street Journal is already there, and it's already there doing quite good political reporting. But it's not clear to me that there's actually a market for, you know, another prestige, you know, down the line center newspaper. And that's a problem because it would be useful in terms of news gathering. But, you know, it's not clear to me that the market would reward it. So I think it's a real problem. And I think the choice that Jeff Bezos made to stop doing endorsements, I think, was a step in the right direction. But I'm not super hopeful about the ability of the press to both, you know, actually change the way that it operates and then to convince people that it's changed the way it operates and then to make money after that change. Those are all things that I think may not work. And so I think that's a real problem.
Yeah. And even to the point of the question, I was thinking like, well, I agree with all that, but I think I'm starting to see, to your point, where people start to mistrust institutions because they realize that y'all all think alike anyway, right? You know, so to your point, yeah. It's like people don't necessarily trust the groupthink, the places where groupthink thrives, right? You know, whether it is, you know, an institution like a publication or, you know, a bigger organization that's like a nonprofit, but obviously a very biased nonprofit, things like that. I was just curious to see what you thought of that, but I do agree with that.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I think, you know, public health is maybe the worst example of this. I think that, you know, we saw through the COVID crisis that the public health establishment is, you know, it consists of people with a very particular political worldview that is in general, very far to the left. And you saw a lot of, you know, the leakage of ideology into science and the conflation of the two. And then you also saw mistakes, which were always going to happen because it was a novel situation. And so that it was already going to be difficult to maintain the public's trust. But people saw that a lot of what was happening was an ideological project. And I think it's a real problem going into the next pandemic that we, you know, have had this huge dissolution of trust in the public health establishment, even though a lot of that dissolution is deserved. It's still going to be a really big problem, you know, next time we have some really deadly virus going around. I'm interested to see how Trump's appointments in this area work because, you know, like Jay Bhattacharya, who's going to run the Centers for Disease Control, I think he got some really important things wrong during COVID. He was right that the establishment was wrong in certain areas, but he also thought that only like tens of thousands of people were going to die. So I'm not super thrilled about that. But on the other hand, you know, if we need someone to tell us next time, oh, this one really is really deadly, people are probably going to be more inclined to trust him than to trust like Anthony Fauci. So maybe that is the best choice available. But I just wish that there had been more humility during the last pandemic that would have preserved some more of that public trust. So we didn't need to rely on someone who, you know, might just have really bad judgment about what's a public health crisis.
Right. Even to your point about the CDC guy you just mentioned, like you're allowed to have non-traditional and nuanced views about things, just like keep the balance within it so that people can maintain the trust.
One hopes.
So I have, I think, one last question, and then the question that I ask everybody, which is what are depolarizing activities that listeners can participate in to help depolarize our politics? And just one last question, I think, about voter demography. You know, I've enjoyed your writings since election on, you know, shifts in people and blah, blah, blah. What do you think are some of the information sources or resources or even cultural indicators that people, party leadership, candidates can look to better understand where voters are on a range of issues, despite their variation in, you know, age or ethnicity or nationality, immigration status, et cetera? You know, where are the vibes going to be most appropriately sourced from so that people can better understand where people are on things?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you're referencing that I wrote a fair amount about there going into the election was this, what looked like really big demographic shifts in the political coalitions that in particular made it likely that the electoral college bias that was so strong against Democrats in 2020 and 2016 was going to fade a lot or go away. And that, in fact, did happen. The electoral college bias in this election was very close to zero. And that basically had to do with Republicans making a lot of gains that were very electorally inefficient. You know, running up the score in Florida and losing by less in New York doesn't get you any additional electoral votes, but it gets you a lot more votes. And also, I mean, it's this kind of funny thing that as the Republican coalition gets more diverse, it gets less electorally efficient. In particular, Hispanic voters are distributed in a way that is very ineffective for trying to win the Electoral College. You know, you get more votes in Florida. There's an area in northern New Jersey where the Republican performance among Hispanic voters was just, you know, off the charts strong compared to past elections. Obviously, gets them no electoral vote, got them no seats in Congress. So it's in a way, it's an unfairness of the system. The Hispanic vote just doesn't count as much as the white vote does. And so as the, you know, as the coalition shifted, the Democrats ended up with a coalition that was more efficient. And if Harris had won the popular vote, she probably would have won the election. To see that coming, I was just looking at the New York Times polling. Nate Cohn, the pollster there, the polls that they do together with Siena College, I think are really the highest quality public polls that are being done right now. And they've been very focused on those stories. So, you know, I think that's a good poll to read if you're trying to figure out where the electorate is going. And I know that, you know, if someone's running a Democratic campaign organization, they have their own private polling that hopefully is also methodologically strong. And, one thing we've learned after the election is that Harris's polling did, in fact, have her down almost all the way through the campaign. So it seems like they knew what was going on, even if they didn't react correctly to it. So I think, you know, it's for that stuff, it's sort of funny. People are, you know, will say like, well, you know, polls, you know, you don't want to be so poll tested. Polls aren't people. Like, polls are the best way to know what the public thinks. It's a lot better than, you know, like looking at, you know, who's a self-appointed spokesperson for some, you know, Asian American Pacific Islander group. Or, you know, if you're a reporter, the media has gotten better about this over the last few years, but it used to be a lot that like if reporters in New York are trying to figure out what Asian voters think, invariably they go to talk to some young progressive activist whose first language is English and are definitely not talking to someone over 50 whose first language is Chinese. And you miss the backlash about crime and, you know, to some extent, the backlash about immigration that was occurring, but that was occurring especially among older and, you know, more socially conservative voters in those communities. I think the press has generally figured that out, but also the polling should help you figure that out, because you ideally you get a representative sample of people and you see we did have warning that these trends were coming with Asian and Hispanic voters, and they did materialize. So I think the main lesson is to be open to the data and not to be, you know, cherry picking the data that tells you what you want to hear. You want to look at the data that says what's actually happening.
100%. And then our depolarizing activity.
A depolarizing activity. I mean, you know, I don't know how much individual voters can do this, but I mean, you know, you have a fairly elite audience here, I hope. I think, you know, we talked about that there's going to be a need for some sort of bipartisan cooperation on immigration and on energy. And, you know, for all the, you know, the Biden administration was, you know, did not meet all of my hopes and dreams for it. But there were a number of these successful bipartisan initiatives, including the bipartisan infrastructure law, the CHIPS Act, some moves related to China. And so I think, you know, if you're a lawmaker in Washington and, it's, you know, what a mess it is that we're going to have another Trump administration, there's still a lot of other policy that needs to be made that is not all about hot button issues, and where there are incentives for Republicans and Democrats to cooperate to fix real problems that exist in the country and in the economy. And, I think permitting and building out energy infrastructure and addressing the gaming of our asylum system would be two items that are at the top of my list. But so I think, you know, Senator Todd Young, for example, is a Republican from Indiana and a pretty conservative Republican. But he sort of looks for these issues that are, you know, sort of like what I described with Josh Shapiro with the college degrees for the jobs, things that are not necessarily left-right issues, where you have opportunities for cooperation across the aisle and where you might fix what someone will see as a problem regardless of what their ideological outlook is. I think that kind of activity is inherently depolarizing because it involves Republicans and Democrats working together to find solutions. And there are a lot of opportunities for that, even in a time in our politics that is very polarized and very nasty. So that's something that, you know, if I were a member of the U.S. Senate, I would be trying to focus on over the next 2 years. It's also a lot less depressing than whatever else it is that one might do as a Democrat in Washington, watching Republicans run the government.
Right. And people at home still want solutions in their government. So got to work on stuff.
Yeah.
Josh, this is awesome. I so appreciate you. Thank you for taking the time, and just super grateful for you and excited to see you in the next time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Lauren.